Look at those sailors, each one sailing in his ship of truth on the restless ocean of samsara, bound for the shoreless infinite. But look and see, there is no ship, only a form mysteriously changing, holding your vision for a while and then vanishing. And then you think you see another form, and again it vanishes into the ocean. But there is no ocean, only emptiness. And again there is a ship on the ocean. But oh, what a sailor! He hoists no sail. He has no rudder. He does not direct himself nor guide the ship. Ceaseless is his action, but there is no activity. And then he becomes invisible. Then suddenly the whole ocean is on fire, but no ships, no sailors. Afterwards, again we see sailors, each in his own motionless ship of truth, on the moving ocean bound for the shoreless infinite. But soon there is only a form fading into extreme emptiness. And is this a nightmare? Are we losing our grip? Surely we are trying to see like sane people, thinking hard to find out the truth like intelligent people. Tell me, is it not happiness not to try to see, but to let the clear eye look, not to try to think the truth, but to let the state of pure mindfulness be the truth? But if you or I can let the eye look and let the mind be, then there is no you or no and no me. And yet, if we wish to communicate this fact, only you can say it and only I can hear it. Do not exert the intellect hoping to grasp this. The intellect will do the needful only in pure mindfulness. So let us all listen with pure listening, not merely hearing words, but hearing with the ear of understanding. Thus we shall be happy with the happiness that is unspoilt by any sensation or by any state of conflict. Listening thus in this happy state, we are awake to beauty, not just to the beauty of speech or of thought or of shape or color, but to the beauty which is not put together in any way. When we are awake to this beauty, which is invisible and intangible, which is neither to be sought nor found, we may see its flash and hear its echo in the word of the enlightened one. And the first word of noble truth of the enlightened one is dukkha. We live in this world of samsara, the universal becoming process. Incalculable is the beginning of this samsara. The earliest point is not revealed of the running on of beings cloaked in ignorance and tied to craving. And the flood of tears shed in this fearing on is more vast than the waters of the four seas. It is through not awakening to four conditions that there has been this woeful wandering in samsara, namely the Aryan virtue, meditation, insight and freedom. Let us consider some points. The becoming process contains you and me and everything else. It goes on continuously. It is time's beginningless and endless totality. Samsara rolls on both because of and also independently of each one of us. There is continuous interaction between the world process and each of us. The whole interacts with the part with the whole, and the parts with each other. Samsara is indeed complex. All too often, it is terribly and painfully complicated. This universal, ever-changing process, as a whole, remains a constant quantity, the parts of which it is composed, such as each of us, come and go. None of us can get rid of samsara. The whole of it is dukkha. Now it is the mind which apprehends dukkha. Suppose we were mindless living bodies and not psychophysical organisms. Suppose all the cells of the body had only an automatic reaction either of attraction or repulsion to all stimuli. Suppose also, and this is important, the cells were incapable of learning, which means mindlessness. Then, for such bodies, there would only be a mechanical reaction to physical stimuli. And if at any time the force of the stimuli exceeded the power of the body to bear them, the body would break up or die. Thus, we would have mechanical physical reactions as long as there was a body, but we would not know grief or happiness, sorrow or joy. Now, dukkha covers the whole psychophysical field, the pain or pleasure of bodily sensations, as well as the joy or grief of the psyche. The interplay of sensation and psychical reactions is very complex. As a simple example, a painful sensation may cause sorrow in one person. That same sensation may give rise to pleasure in another person. Again, that which gives rise to sorrow in a person is in one situation may please that same person in another situation. From birth onwards, every object, person, action, sensation, experience, in short, everything that makes up our daily life receives a name. By repetition, this name, which is a word, becomes fixed and is stored up in memory. Gradually, a whole statement or a set of statements relating to that object or experience is stored up as memory. When the same object is again present, out come the statements, that is, strings of words spill out of the memory box. As commonly said, we recognize the object. But note very carefully, this is a conditioned recognition. We are, in fact, when looking at the object, only seeing our mental constructs, which are but fixations or dead mental matter. When we come across something quite new, we are incapable of a pure, true cognition, because we rummage immediately in our memory cupboard for a set of fixations which are not there, into which we can fit the new thing confronting or challenging us. In other words, we are incapable of a new pure seeing, of a new pure hearing, without interference from the conditioned superficial mind, which is mostly a chaos of words. So we can hardly even begin to be sensible, leave alone be truly attentive or perceptive. If we understand this, we can see why fixed beliefs, doctrines, conclusions drawn from past experience, and especially the blind acceptance of authority, are obstacles to insight. All that is conveyed to us through the senses undergoes interpretation by the chattering brain. Unfortunately, too many of these interpretations are hopelessly untrue to the actual fact, and the becoming process is seen and experienced fantastically. Confusion reigns in the mind, for the apprehension of the whole of samsara is a misapprehension, and ignorant craving goads us constantly into the conflict of pleasure-seeking versus pain-avoiding. So the mind is never free of dukkha. At the same time, it holds a central position in relation to dukkha. No mind, no dukkha. Existing in samsara, Siddhartha Gautama was well aware of dukkha. We as we are always want to be rid of dukkha, to avoid it or overcome it or run away from it. We regard it only as suffering, and so we want and seek the reverse of it, namely joy. Not so Gautama. He had no use for either of the opposites. He rejected all duality and sought the transcendent, nothing less than the deathless, nothing less than the uttermost security from the bonds. Nibbana was his all-absorbing concern. The Pali Nibbana is the same as the Sanskrit Nirvana. And Nibbana, the deathless, was realized through him. Siddhartha Gautama, becoming enlightened, the Buddha was there. Now we have the second and third words of noble truth. Sambodha, perfect enlightenment, and Nibbana. Let us regard Nibbana here as perfect life, perfect being. Let us leave this now and return to it later. The ill state of the mind is our problem. Let us first appreciate a nice point regarding samsara and dukkha. As we have already seen, samsara, which includes all of us who are temporal manifestations of this world process, goes on continuously through chronological time, and no one can get rid of it. The enlightened one, even as the unenlightened one, eats and drinks, talks with people, rests, changes his clothes, bathes, travels from place to place, notices the weather conditions and adjusts his activities accordingly, etc. This is his samsara. He attends to his bhikkhu's training and growth, to their needs and to their disciplinary and other problems as they arise. This is his daily work, his samsara. If now he becomes anxious or disappointed or annoyed, and there are occasions when he did express annoyance on account of the weather or the misdeeds or dullness of the bhikkhus, he would be caught in the toils of dukkha. Now the whole of samsara is dukkha. Nevertheless, an enlightened one is altogether free of dukkha in certain respects, but only partially free in other respects. Unenlightenment is the supreme dukkha. But if a brick fell on the Buddha, or if he got violent indigestion, which actually did happen in his life, he would certainly suffer physical pain, which is dukkha, though he would be free because of perfect mindfulness from the associated emotional mental disturbance, which is the dukkha that ordinary folk would additionally feel. Thus, enlightenment spells partial freedom from dukkha in relation to certain aspects of samsara. But there is a dukkha from which the enlightened one is not free. In fact, he bears this dukkha more than any unenlightened one. Indeed, it is his prerogative to do so. This dukkha bears fruit as his insight and compassion, panya and karuna. Seeing the dukkha of the world, he does not cut adrift from it. He lives in pure and complete relationship to it, perfectly mindfully and fully awake to all samsara dukkha. This is a transcendental dukkha. It has its roots in that beautiful wound of divine love which irresistibly drives one to seek the unborn. This unborn is the unconditioned, the pure state of the void, which by the rhythmic pulse of pure motion through it gives rise to the universe and its becoming process, samsara. The universe, which is the born, is the finite and conditioned, emerging out of the infinite unconditioned, a mortal child of its immortal source, subject to aging, decay and death, in short, to dukkha. Treasure that wound of love, that pure passion which moves us towards the unconditioned. Unless the flame of enlightening love lights us again into the unborn, our life has no significance. Any effort to be rid of dukkha or to escape from samsara is doomed. Were there not this dukkha of the conditioned state, that is jati, the born, there would not be either the stimulus or the means for the liberation into the unconditioned. Dukkha is indispensable for realizing the bliss of Nibbana. Awaken to the beauty of this, that beauty of all beauty, which is beyond all the beauties of our existence in duality, is the beauty of the unconditioned unborn. The beauty that we know here in samsara is merely the contrast to ugliness. This preferential beauty, this discriminated ugliness, is a manifestation of the conflict produced by the pleasure-pain principle at work. This is dukkha. In the enlightened state, one sees that the named beautiful and the named ugly are the changeful, ephemeral play of that immortal beauty that knows not birth nor death. Because the enlightened one holds samsara in his heart and integrates dukkha into his being, because he sees with the eye of compassion and hears with the ear of understanding, he is equal-minded towards the ugliness, beauty, duality of the world. He is all awake to the beauty of the unborn, unconditioned. But remember, he is awake to immortal beauty because he holds samsara in his heart and integrates the world woe into his being. There is something wonderful we can learn here. To the impure mind, in bondage, samsara is the dukkha, which is the conflict of pain and ugliness on the one hand, with pleasure and beauty on the other. To the pure mind, free of the bonds, samsara is just the all-inclusive becoming process, a harmony in itself. And further, the pure mind understands a deep meaning of dukkha, namely, that dukkha is not the infinite nor the unconditioned. It is the infinite sundered into multitudinous finites, the unconditioned constrained into innumerable conditioned particulars or states, jatis, births. Jati is usually translated as birth, but it is wise to translate it in most instances as a conditioned state. The one become the many. See this and you have the wisdom gone beyond. See this and you realize the not-two-ness of samsara nirvana. Had there been no Gautama in samsara, could there have been a Buddha in nirvana? Now perhaps it will be easier to understand a point of poignant significance. Let us look quietly into our own heart and truly see and honestly acknowledge a deeply repressed fact. When we turn to the deeps of religion, when we strive to tread the way, when we fight against evil, do we not turn away from the world with revulsion? Have we not a deep resentment against life because we were frustrated? A hate against man and circumstances for hurting and depriving us? And so, is not all our striving for liberation, for seeing truth, for serving man or God or the cause, a perpetuation of a state of conflict, a self-centered compensatory activity, a subtle expression of delusion, hate and greed? The conscious mind will find many reasons to repudiate this fact, because the ego will not disgorge its selfness. But look within. Look patiently and lovingly. You and the world are like man and wife, indissolubly married. What you do to the world has to take. Nothing can be thrown out of the cosmos. What the world does to you, you have to deal with. Do not hate hate. Do not grab greed, for then we hate our own self, for selfness is hate, selfness is greed, and to hate oneself is to hate all others and all else. Whilst there is resentment against the world, and as long as there is hate against our own self, we cannot tread the way. To live the holy life does not merely mean to fight against evil and promote good. Samsara is the world of relativity. Good and evil are relative terms. Through wisdom and love, the bad becomes good and the good becomes better. Love and wisdom never fight. They simply transform. Let us look searchingly into this, or else we shall never be free of our inner conflict which so successfully prevents our treading the way. Our concern to tread the way brings us to the fourth word of noble truth, Dhamma. Its root is dhri, meaning to uphold. We have already seen the not-two-ness of samsara nirvana. We know the usual meaning of dukkha, the ill state, suffering, sin, death, etc. And we have had at least a glimpse of the transcendental end to which it can lead us, namely the harmony of the conditioned and the unconditioned, the many and the one. Dhamma is the upholding of this harmony. This is not a vain or escapist fancy. At the same time, it is true that our fact here and now is dukkha, which is suffering. What has gone wrong? Consider silently. At first, there was only the heart or the whole mind. Regard this whole mind or heart as the receptive, responsive sensitivity of the living psychophysical organism called man. At first, the heart was almost in a slumbering state, unawakened, swayed by the wind of desire contrary to Dhamma. It was moved by the curiosity to know discriminatively, to measure and to compare. It felt the urge to experiment. So, out of the heart, there came intellect, which soon began to dominate the heart. It separated out this and that, the pleasant and the painful, and it made the unawakened man exercise choice, taking sides with pleasure against pain. In the heart, the unity is undisturbed, and there is the harmony of the many in the one. In the intellect, there is the tearing out of the many from the one. The heart is unself-conscious. It shelters the self-conscious intellect and nurtures it. When the unruly, cruel intellect has become well-disciplined, it returns to the peace of the heart. Then the heart is enriched with intelligence and is awake. In the heart is the rhythm of life. When the intellect has become the faultless beat of that life rhythm, then knowing by the heart, which is true knowledge, wisdom, comes into its own. Now the tree of knowledge is one with the tree of life. All that you come to know by the undisciplined intellect divides, and your samsara is a sea of suffering. All that you know by the awakened heart, you know by love. And love knows the many as the one and the one as the many. Undisciplined intellect brings you the conflicting alternation of birth and death. The heart of love holds birth and death as a unity, and indeed the whole of samsara and dukkha in the harmony of egoless being. This is why a little earlier I call Nibbana perfect life, perfect being. The harmony of egoless being is grounded on Dhamma. Dhamma sings the bass of the harmony of the song of life. We can see now where and how impurity steals into our lives and besmirches our daily Dhamma. the divisive intellect makes us take sides, and desirous thought plans the course for the gratification of greed, for the venting of anger, and for the foolish activities born of delusion. Therefore, conflict rages, and we heap ill state upon ill state. The Buddha taught very simply, cease to do evil, learn to do good, purify the mind. That is the way of the Buddhas. Here we come to a crucial point. There must be no conflict between good and evil if there is to be a true flowering of insight and compassion. To start with, put aside fixed definitions of good and evil. Then be fully attentive to everything from moment to moment. There must be pure observation only, without praise or censure, without attraction and attachment, or repulsion and aversion, without any interference, in short, from the conditioned mind. Which means from the total past, from accumulated karma. This is extraordinarily revealing and difficult. The constant reactions which spring up in the mind as we try to observe prevent wholly attentive, bare observation. For example, look at that man. Immediately I see him, he is labeled. That man was my husband. My past experience of him, stored up in the recesses of my mind, is associated with that label. The nice things about him, his abilities, kindnesses, and so on, as well as his blind spots, the hurts and frustrations, and so on. Thus, when I look at him, I am mostly looking at my rag bag of mental constructs of him, but not at him, the living being, as he is in himself at this very moment. Moreover, as I look, various approvals and disapprovals, reactions of attraction and antipathy, various wishes and longings, schemes and ideas may all crowd into my mind. How then can I understand him, or be in true relationship with him, with all this disturbance in my mind? How can there be freedom from dukkha, or a ceasing from evil? Now, my business is not to repress or forcibly cut off all this seething confusion in the mind. I must note it well, for it reveals my own conditioning. It discloses the stuff which I call my mind. It lays bare the disease of the mind. But this revelation must not be allowed to remain and rot as mere information, for mere information does not purify the mind or cure the disease. The cure or the purification must be allowed to come about. The living mind, like the living cell in the body, is self-healing. If I condemn an attempt to replace the ill state by a preconceived good state, I only perpetuate the conflict. I only slide out of one conditioning into another. I must therefore, and this is the point which is so difficult to appreciate and to carry out, I must do nothing about it, except to keep looking at it intently, letting the mind remain as silent but as alert as possible. The ill state I am looking at is a psychical complex, a sankhara. If I do not succeed
in maintaining bare attention to it, to its very end, part of that sankhara is left over. This is a substrate for rebirth, as the Buddha said. Next time I look at that man, it comes up again, the rebirth. And in the interval, things may have happened to strengthen that sankhara. But if I do succeed, then this bare, pure, sustained and complete attentiveness dissolves the obstruction in the mind as well as the me, which is the self-conscious observer. Now there is understanding, because the unerring insight of the heart is at work instead of intellectual analysis. And there is free communion, because ungrasping, unpossessive love is unhindered. Thereupon, there is no conflicting duality of observer and observed, but only the harmony of pure vision in which observer and observed are not two. Furthermore, with the complete dissolution of the sankhara, there is no substrate for rebirth. Instead, as the Buddha said, there is the realization of the not put together, that is, the unconditioned. This also means death, which is the extinction of continuity and the extinction of psychological time whilst alive in the world. Psychological time is the havoc maker in the psyche, for psychological time is the disturbance caused by the intrusion of desirous thought into the rhythmic flow of life through chronological time. With the extinction of psychological time, though you live bodily through all events in chronological time, your attention functions in the timeless. Without this timeless attentiveness, there is no spiritual insight, panya. With it, and with the extinction of psychological time, whilst alive in this world, there is the experiencing of immortality, the deathless, and nirvana's ineffable peace is yours. But do remember, there is no I, a separate self-conscious entity which enters nirvana, a particular state. It is nearer the mark to say that the unconditioned unborn realizes its own immortality through the living man who is completely enfolded and suffused by the transcendental silence. This is the cessation or the stopping of feeling and perception, as the Buddha said. If we do see all this, we will realize something priceless. In our spiritual life, in true meditation, this silent, alert, complete attentiveness is transcendental, creative action, unspoiled and uninterrupted by finite activities proceeding out of desirous thought. But all finite activities which are these spontaneous expressions of the transcendental action will inevitably be right activities through which creative renewal is manifest. Sri Krishna said, "He who seeth inaction in activity and action in inaction, he is wise among men. He is harmonious even while engaged in all activities." Now you may see why I said how strange was our sailor who did nothing in his ship and yet was in ceaseless action. this bare attentiveness, free of tanha, free of all interference by the conditioned mind, is the great purifying, liberating and transmuting power that we all possess. When we use it, that to which we attend is not pushed aside or merely changed in form or brought into conflict with a thought out better or annihilated. It is restored to its original shunyata, to the pristine purity of the void. It cannot resist this restoration because it in itself is anatta. By this mindfulness, there is not a mere reconditioning out of one conditioned state into a different conditioned state, for there is a liberation into the freedom of the unconditioned. We may see then how not to participate in the conflict of good and evil, in the sphere of duality. Attend completely to either the relative good or the relative evil of samsara, and both duals are transmuted in the liberation into the unconditioned. This is the end of all ill, all dukkha. Let us look at our four words, Dhamma, Sambodha, Nibbana and Dukkha, in this diagrammatic form. Now watch what happens. With the ending of dukkha, samsara is suffused with the light of nirvana, and we have the harmony of the four in one. The Dhamma is only a raft to carry us to the other shore. Dispense with the raft on the other shore, and we have the harmony of the three in one. In cessation, samsara vanishes, and we have the harmony of the two in one. Whether there be or be not a perfected holy being in samadhi, Nibbana is everlasting. After the two are reduced to the one, to what is the one reduced? To the shunya, which is not zero. It is empty of thing and also of nothingness. It is the beauty which is not put together in any way. But thou who art here and now in samsara, watch carefully. After enlightenment, the perfected Holy One returns from the solitary infinitude of silent communion back to the marketplace and smilingly sits in peace in the midst of the hubbub of ignorance. Oh, what harmony!